Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you this weekend. We have a partial encore show with one new guest appearance from technical investor Avi Gilbert from Elliott Wave Trading makes his debut on the show. Then an encore performance from Catherine Austin Fitz, Arch Crawford, and Robert Ian. Next week, the regular crew returns. Stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Crawford combines technical analysis with planetary alignments and astronomical anomalies for 30 years. Welcome back, Arch Crawford.
It was 38 in May.
Arch, it's great to have you back. I wonder if you could give us your thoughts on this Greek drama. I mean, that is the topic du jour.
Well, they are saying whatever is happening, whether it's Greek or not, will be much worse on the 14th and 15th. There's a very massive multi-planet alignment that is more or less significantly difficult or negative. So I'm watching for that, and then the next one after that I think is around the end of the month, and then we get September looks much, much worse for everything.
So the worst may not be behind the markets just yet.
You know, if you were watching Sunday afternoon on the E-minis when they opened at 6 o'clock Eastern, they were down about 41 points on the S&P, which usually would have been about 350 on the Dow. The Dow futures opened a little bit later, and they were not down anywhere near that much, but they were down about 220. They spent yesterday coming all the way back overnight mostly, and then during the day continued moving higher, although they were still down on the day. The Dow actually closed up $9, I think, after being down, should have been down over 350. So there's a very heavy manipulation going on in here still, as we've talked about many times before.
You're right that the pre-market futures for the S&P and the Dow were off sharply. In fact, there was quite a gap down lower by several hundred points on the Dow. And we saw that fill abruptly over the next several hours before the market opened. I don't have time to follow the markets during the week, but I like to see them pre-market. We had a big gap down that probably led to some covering by the shorts amid the panic selling. You know, the smart money was covering its shorts there probably. Once you start to see this type of volatility enter the market, typically a downtrend follows, and it looks like that's what you're expecting here.
I just put out my newsletter yesterday. That's the July the 6th. We have in there the Shanghai chart, which has broken two very important trend channel lines from way back. One quote about it was, "The second largest stock market in the entire world is collapsing right in front of our eyes. Over the past several months, I've been trying to hammer home the comparison between what we are experiencing right now and the lead up to the U.S. financial crisis in the second half of 2008. Then I have the chart of the velocity of M2, which has dropped to below the low of anything since they started charting it in 1959 or so. So that means that all this new money that's coming in, nobody is spending it. And that is a very serious situation, and it's more serious than the Greek, because the China market has lost $3 trillion worth of value since June the 12th. That is, you know, utterly amazing to me. Now, the Dow Jones and the S&P came down. The Dow broke the 200-day moving average a little over a week ago, briefly, and then quickly recovered and went back below it, I think, Friday. Or maybe it was Monday of last. It was Monday of last week that it hit the low, or Tuesday morning. And then it bounced just up to the long-term trend line, which it had just broken. And now it has come down and broken those lows as of today on the day-only cash Dow Jones. So that's long-term trend lines and 200-day moving average. If we close anywhere near down here, we'll look pretty terrible from the technical standpoint. The S&P came down to the 200-day a week ago, rallied up to that trend channel line again, and then has come back to a new low today, but it's above it. Now it says the cash is only down 547 at 2063, which is back above the 200-day moving average. The NASDAQ never did break the 200-day yet. The NASDAQ 100 is the, you know, the premier part of the NASDAQ. But these intermediate to long-term, they're breaking intermediate and long-term support levels, which means that they could go a lot further.
Excellent analysis, and I am seeing weakness developing throughout the charts. You know, we had Ralph Acampora, I believe it was, recently discussing some of his concerns with regard to non-confirmation relative to the Dow. And, of course, this goes way back to Dow theory, even Charles Dow.
Well, I had that on the cover of my last, the June letter, had the death cross in the Dow transports. And they've continued on down since then.
But we've all watched these markets now for so long. There is a tendency for the sky is falling rhetoric to pop up after such a long advance.
I think the damage here is greater than you will be able to make another new high. If it does it before September, it's still possible. But from September, I think we're going to get extremely serious things going on, and it could happen in July because we have the middle of July and near the end of July that look nasty from the sky view, but the September is some of the worst that we have seen, some major events in the world.
From my trend analysis and momentum indicators, I can't buy the top is in yet. I need more confirmation on a longer term basis. You know, hat tip to you all if you've caught the cycle peak here, because I tend to ignore the peaks and troughs and shoot for the trends in the middle. So I am always late to the party, fashionably late to the peak here perhaps, but I'm still on record saying that I expect higher highs in these markets. I think it's going to stun a lot of people. And one of my favorite indicators is the blogosphere. Pun intended here, the blog-o-f-e-a-r. The blogosphere is what I'm calling it now because it's no longer a sphere. It's just filled with fear. And I don't like to see that type of a fear level at a market peak. I expect more euphoria and complacency. I know it's more of a qualitative set of indicators. I'm all ears to your methodology, and we certainly need to listen to diverse opinions. Give us an idea, then, of what you think is going to be the impetus driving these markets lower, and then where will the next bull market emerge?
I'm thinking that the next bear market is going to be so bad that we might not ever recover as a civilization.
Okay, we're talking a deflationary collapse, almost like a complete reset of the system. The Kondratieff winter?
Yes, absolutely.
That's pretty extreme, Arch.
Well, look at the debt levels worldwide. They're pretty extreme, and they're not ever going to be paid off unless we go into hyperinflation, which, you know, pay them off with a couple of trillion dollars.
Just walking around money, right, in hyperinflation. The fiat money system, you know, this entire idea of fractional banking is, I think, predicated on the idea that you cannot ever pay it off because so much money is printed into existence and they can print an endless amount of money at no cost to them. They don't even have to pay for ink and cloth anymore.
They just push the button.
You've got robots pressing the digital money button, and all you have to do is just walk by every 6 months or so and put a little oil.
On the three keys, the one for the billions, the one for the trillions, and the one for the...
Okay, clearly then you're looking for a reset moment. You're looking for a house of cards implosion where the house of cards is extended so high, let's say to the lunar surface, that as it's imploding, we don't even notice it on terra firma.
Well, if you didn't notice, we just went by Pluto.
We're actually reaching Voyager 1 now. levels. I mean, we're outside the solar system. Okay, I'll stop with the silly metaphor. You know, arch fear sells, and we've all been accused online of being fear mongers. I'll be honest with you, I tend to gravitate towards fear related articles, and I think it's just subconscious.
Well, it's nothing, I've not promoted anything that I don't believe myself. As that goes, what is it? If you can keep your head while all about you are losing theirs, you probably don't understand the seriousness of the conditions.
So let's give folks an idea. Let's try to substantiate this idea that the ultimate day of reckoning that has been thrown around for over 15 years on the internet might actually happen this time. That we're crying wolf, but this time there are several packs of wolves encompassing the little cottage, the small community. Is this really the end game? And let's outline some solid bullet points.
Well, one is the Greek exit or the Greek bankruptcy. The only major country that we've had in bankruptcy was Argentina. I think they did it several times over 100 years. But other than that, it's been just Zimbabwe and like manner countries. But Greece is a substantial country. It's not a large country, but it is, I would have to say, substantial. And then what's happening now is has developed worse in China with the crash taking place. It's down, what, 25% in 3 weeks.
It's a remarkable smackdown. I remember last Friday reading a report that said the Shanghai index was down 30% from its high to the low. And I thought, well, that's got to be, they've added an extra zero in there. I had to pull up the chart because it had been such a impressive rally. We've seen instances like this. For instance, 1987, the S&P 500 was off roughly 20, 25%. I think it was almost exactly 25%. And within about 6 months' time, the recovery began. And I'd say within, by 1988, the summer of 88, we'd recovered all of, not most, of that initial 25% haircut.
I remember that the single day drop was 22%. And I had predicted, I made my name in Wall Street with that drop because I predicted the day and that there would be a crash after that top day exact 3 weeks prior to the top day.
Isn't that funny? And I remember the day like it was yesterday. I was just starting college. Everyone knows your call. It made your career. And you're looking for another decline, but this time it could make what happened in 87 seem insignificant.
Well, it won't be insignificant because it was a record setter for all time so far. But even if this one could be worse because it could end freedoms in the West.
So you're expecting then a Jade Helm martial law moment?
Yes. Well, Jade Helm begins in a few days and goes on for 2 months. And I think near the end of that is when we get all of these negative, really powerful negatives in the sky and the eclipse series and Armstrong's Pi date. A number of other people are looking for September to be difficult for other different reasons.
Oh, sure. No, we talked about the rabbi, his Shemitah 7-year cycle. Yeah, it comes to pass in this fall, which also seems to coincide with Martin Armstrong's, as you mentioned, Pi cycle, which is roughly 7 years, give or take, at least when I've tried to back engineer it a few times here. Plus, we have a presidential election coming up. There are elections in the works in the next year or two. It's not terribly favorable of a season. Some difficult fall period, September, October. But, you know, if we look back at the Treasury Department and the Fed's playbook circa 2008-2009, and we saw how they reacted to big 700-point down days, 900-point days on the Dow, almost 1,000 from peak to trough. I mean, they essentially threw everything they had at the problem. I mean, it was damage control, fired up the printing presses, and you can be sure they're going to try everything they can this time, but we don't have a Hank Paulson. We don't have Ben Bernanke at the helm. We have a different team. What happens this time?
Well, I remember that day of the TARP, and the Senate voted it down, And the next day, they told the senators, if you do not vote this today, we will be in martial law tomorrow. And that is why the Senate passed it.
I think Price tells about 95% of the truth. I don't think it's too much hyperbole to suggest that the markets did come to a close on many levels between 2008-2009. I mean, many, many stocks, Apple, for instance, IBM, many of these high flyers could be purchased for pennies, literally on the dollar, were it not for government intervention. And dare I say, you know, deus ex machina, a divine intervention. That's really what it amounted to. We wouldn't have markets today, and we might very well have a different flag or multiple flags flying over the United States. There is a really fantastic science fiction writer, Philip K. Dick, you might recall, amazingly troubled man, but probably one of the greatest creative thinkers since H.G. Wells, wrote many, many novels, most of which now have been movies, Blade Runner, Minority Report, Total Recall, you know, so many of these huge blockbusters. He never earned a penny off of any of it, sadly. He also wrote a book called The Man in the High Castle, and that's essentially a story that seems to be almost playing out now about what if the Axis powers had won the war. Well, isn't it interesting that Europe, to me, is behaving like a community, very similar to if maybe they hadn't won the war, but there'd been an armistice?
Well, I'm reading the Wall Street Journal today, and they're talking about the rest of Europe being angry about the power that Germany has over the EU. So, literally, you're correct.
But that doesn't change the fact that there's going to be animosity, huge animosity, that begins to develop against the haves and the have-nots. We are entering a period where there's going to be a huge stigma, chasm between the haves and the have-nots. There is class struggle and potential warfare. I would like for you to kind of kick the feet up on the ottoman, grab your pipe, kick back, and tell people how you think just how this might play out here.
Well, de Tocqueville was one of the first analyzers of the democratic process, and he wrote that the problem with a democracy is that the have-not can vote themselves whatever they want, and that eventually causes the downfall into a situation run primarily by the business corporations. And that's fascist. And you have to have a strong man to tell the kids that they can't have any more candy. And that's why democracies turn into fascist governments. And a woman wrote a book, Naomi Wolf, in the 90s about the end of America. And she had 10 things that would happen that would cause us to move to a fascist police state. And the 10th one was when the government 3 or 4 years ago ordered 20,000 drones. And so she said we were a police state as of that day, all 10 things had happened.
She's revisited her bullet points over the years and reiterates your point that, you know, we've all followed Naomi Wolf's work over the years and many, many others. Certainly the bedrock has been laid here. You know, I mean, we have the foundation for dictatorship. They're just waiting, I think, don't you agree, Arch, for the right moment to put it into play?
Well, it's actually been into play because what the people voted for in several instances now have been reversed by judges primarily. And one of the latest thing is just has been that there were 31 state votes on same-sex marriages, and 30 of them said no. And now the Supreme Court has said it's the law of the land. And so that and the thing of making corporations equal to a citizen in terms of what they can pay out on the elections and whatnot, these are things that have already destroyed any kind of democratic republic that we had for whatever time we had it. I remember Ben Franklin says, Well, you have a republic if you can keep it.
Certainly, it was nearly severed in twain in the 1860s. That was, according to some historians, not much of a close call. But tell that to the hundreds of thousands who lost their lives and limbs at that time. Catastrophic event.
What most people do not realize is that the bankers in Europe were annoyed that we got away from them, and they sent members of an organization called the Jacobins here to foment the war.
Oddly enough, I address that. Of course, now I stand on the shoulders of giants when I do it, but in Wealth Building Strategies 2010, I talk just about that, how the War of 1812 was a banking war. Much of the conflict, you know, you recall Andrew Jackson's edict about how he would...
By one vote, they failed in putting him out of office.
I'd like to get an idea of how do you see this playing out? Because you've made a really profound, unsettling prediction or probable outcome. It's feasible. If that's the case, keeping in mind that we know they're going to throw everything, including the kitchen sink, at the problem... Okay, the powers that be. How bad does it get, and how similar to the 2008-2009 credit crisis will this be?
It may start off like it, but I think it's going to get out of hand this time, so that by 2017, I think much worse will happen this fall or next year. So maybe we could be getting things back together a little bit by late 2017. I doubt if it'll be, there may be a president in name, but it'll be a dictator in fact.
So you think they'll hold the current 48 contiguous states in place? They won't be fractured regionally, but it may be a police state.
Yes, that it becomes obvious that we've already got a police.
Are you concerned at all about these red and blue lists? Supposedly, according to Alex Jones, former governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura, a few other sources indicating, Dr. Stanley Monteith, a few others, that there are red lists and blue lists, and if you are unfortunate enough to find your name on one of the red lists, that around the time of martial law, you might just not be easy to locate for your friends and family.
I'm aware of all of that, and I think it is either going to happen that the current president may there'll be some kind of another black flag event, and possibly nuclear, and the president will say, "I'm sorry, we can't have an election now," or there'll be a backlash from the right that takes over and put in the strong man, but there'll be greater emphasis on bringing order out of chaos, which is communist mandate.
Right, Hegelian dialectic, exactly. You initiate a problem, and then you have the solution. Of course, if you have all the power, that is, you know, who cares who's the standing president when you can print money all day long, any amount you need. My guess is that you're slowly continuing with your monthly plan of throwing a few cannolis at S&P shorts at this point.
Yes, I keep rotating a handful of options. I remember in 08, I put $2,500 into S&P options and took out $500,000. Steady, and it's actually been a steady train up to now.
Yeah, but, you know, when it pays off big. I mean, again, I think we mentioned last time that that's virtually the playbook for Nassim Taleb, Fooled by Randomness, The Black Swan, and so many fantastic articles and concepts. I guess it's Dr. Taleb now, up at New York University, I think it's City of New York. Had a hedge fund for a very brief period of time, did phenomenally well, and, of course, he followed that playbook exactly. You put the bulk 90% of your funds in bonds or whatever is considered as safe as cash, throws off a little bit of interest, and the remaining 5 or 10% you put into extremely out of the money calls and puts. It certainly can pay off, and when it pays off big. The main point is you never blow up your account because he is not a believer in the, as I'm sure you know, Gaussian distribution, the standard normal that we use so frequently in science, He's a bigger believer that when we're dealing with behavioral science, that people act in very irrational times in extreme ways, just like a panicking herd. And under that type of situation, you get fat tails, you get kurtosis, right? You have kurtotic distribution, or what's called the Pareto distribution. Then you have extremes, and basically this is all just jargon for much greater extremes in prices than forecasted by almost any model. So you can suddenly tomorrow wake up and you're in a credit crisis.
I wrote about this. I did a study on the changes on the open and on the close on the Dow Jones going back 50 or 60 years, and it showed that it happened fairly moderately up until the last 3 or 4 years, in which case it's been extending on the open and on the close. Largely, in other words, we're getting the fat tails there, and we have been already for a couple of years. And the next week, the Wall Street Journal published it, and my chart, and didn't give us any reference to us on in the article.
I have a feeling that those of us who follow your work can appreciate your findings. What do you attribute to that, and what do you think it portends for the market?
I think it portends that there are forces in the marketplace that are making sure it looks good at the close.
Intervention, again, that divine intervention, deus ex machina. How interesting. So the term actually comes from the Latin and the Greek, where they would have the machine, or that's what they called the crane at the time, the machina, lower down the divinity, the divine, from the sky to work out the problem in the play. It looks like that invisible hand is hard at work.
It does appear that way. And I said that this doesn't prove the point, but it suggests that you should look at it. Well, look at my May newsletter. I think I send them to you. I don't know if you get them or not.
I haven't seen one in a while, but I'll certainly review it.
Okay, I'll send it to you. Make sure you have it and put you back on the list if you've slipped off under another.
One of those spam-filled emails that I no longer bother even trying to open.
I had that happen in the last 3 months.
And I wonder if you could tell people more about the service you provide, as well as any contact information that you'd like to leave with the listeners today.
The easiest way is to Google my name, Arch Crawford, and then you get the website at www.crawfordperspectives.com. The phone number here is 520-577-1158. And we follow the stock market, general market timing. We don't do anything with stocks, individual stocks. We talk about gold. We talk about rates and bonds. We talk about the U.S. dollar and the oil and give opinions on most of those.
This is going on 40 years of analysis.
Yes. Well, when I was 20, I took a bus to New York City, transferred up from Merrill Lynch, and shortly after that I became the first assistant ever to their technical analyst, Robert Farrell, who became a legend in his own time, being always voted as the best on Wall Street in the major magazine polls from Wall Streeters. That was 1961 to 64. I didn't start my newsletter till 13 years after I left there.
Promising you this for almost a decade, but there's a wonderful book out of print. I think it was a bestseller back in the late 1800s on Wall Street, but it's the story of an immigrant who comes to the United States and he settles in at an apple orchard in the New York area at about your age when you arrived in New York, and he began to trade the markets only 100% based on astronomical events and patterns that he found in the heavens. He made quite a fortune and then helped many other people along the line, immigrants as well as Americans.
Well, I have not heard about that. The first one I heard of was, no, I've got lots of out-of-print books.
I actually purchased it from a company that specializes in financial tomes that are out of print 10, 15 years ago, and it's sitting up in my family attic, nice and dry. Next time I wander up that way as I move the snake skins and cobwebs out of the way, I'll see if I can grab that copy and send it to you. All right, Arch Crawford, thanks so much, and have a great remainder of the day.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show the president of Solari and publisher of the Solari Report, former Assistant Secretary of Housing and Federal Housing Commissioner. And it's just great to have Catherine Austin Fitz on the show. Hello.
Chris, great to be back.
It's a pleasure. And start off today with your latest big report on infrastructure. You know, this is so key, and it seems to be something that we have forgotten here in the United States. I mean, there's a lot of literature that seems to propose that the United States pulled itself out of the Great Depression and became sort of an economic powerhouse, at least in part, by building up the roads, the railways, the airports, and supporting infrastructure. It creates jobs. It makes a more productive and efficient society. And we're seeing other countries follow that blueprint, such as China. You're concerned that we might be missing the significance of infrastructure.
I looked at infrastructure only because it was popping up in the news. And the question in my mind was, why? We know that certainly in the overt economy, the U.S. has let the infrastructure run down, but that wasn't my primary focus. If you're going to keep global growth going, particularly in the emerging markets, you're going to have to build infrastructure forward. And so we see the BRIC nations pushing to build that infrastructure forward, as, you know, they should and they must and they need to. And the U.S. and G7 kind of balking and getting upset as the emerging markets and the BRICS push by them. And as you mentioned, China just very successfully launched the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and I think that's got the competition revved up a little bit. Anyway, so I decided several months ago to take a look at infrastructure, because it used to be my beat when I was on Wall Street. I did a lot of infrastructure financing. And I was very surprised at what I found, Chris. Infrastructure's in the news for a variety of reasons. One, of course, is the emerging markets. But the other thing is, if you look at what is happening with artificial intelligence and automation, including robotics, we're about to break loose an enormous amount of capacity in terms of our manufacturing and production base. That's a good thing. One, because if you look at what we're doing as a society in space, if we're going to go into space in a big way, and it's clear that I think the global interests in the U.S. are planning on doing that, we need to break free. We need a much more powerful industrial base than we have, or manufacturing base than we have. So that's number one. But the other thing is, as you break through capacity, that gives us the capacity to do infrastructure globally, and I think we have underinvested. Now, at the same time, McKinsey Global Institute just did a big study or a series of studies on infrastructure and related productivity. And what they basically came to the conclusion of is, between now and 2030, globally, they estimate we need to make an investment of about $57 trillion, and that doesn't include space infrastructure. And if you look at those numbers, it's happening just at the time that our capacity in the bond market and the long-term bull in the bond market is coming to the end. So the question is, how do you radically increase your investment in infrastructure at the very same time that your primary source of financing infrastructure is tapping out? We looked very much at that. You know, I've beaten the drum a lot about the fact that I think the leadership has sucked a lot of capital, including by illegal methods, out of what I call global 2.0, or the industrial economy. And basically what we've done is we've levered governments up, we've sucked the cash out and moved it into private hands, or the assets. It can be the money or the assets. And we've stuck the liabilities back in, and now we're saying, oh, there's no money, oh, there's no money. Well, if you look at where we sucked all that $40 trillion to, over here in global 3.0, there's plenty of money. So, but there's this bifurcation in the economy. In one part of the economy, everybody thinks the end of the world is coming, it's all going to collapse. And the other part of the economy, everybody's, you know, it's happy days are here again. And it's, you know, I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like I have a bungee rope in my head going back and forth between the two economies, trying to make sense of what's going on. But at the heart of all of that is infrastructure, because it's traditionally been governments and the bond market that financed it. You know, but the money's sitting over here on the piled high waiting to go into the real economy. And the question is, okay, how are we going to engineer all of this? And how are we going to engineer the geopolitics of it, which, as we can tell from what happened in the markets. So my title for the infrastructure piece was Infrastructure, Conquest or Creation? And, you know, the reality is if you look at how much infrastructure we've destroyed in the last 20 years just fighting, there's a part of your budget. Anyway, infrastructure's right at the heart of sort of the question of how we move forward. And the place I came out of was I realized, you know, if you look at the kind of people you want leading, it's a very different set of people than if you want to build. So the people you use to steal the $40 trillion and move it over here to Global 3.0 are very different than the people you want reinvesting it.
Isn't that something? And it sounds, you know, like the entrepreneur has been pushed out. The rest of the folks who want to create and produce, they have to go off on their own and see if they can make it happen as entrepreneurs.
If you look at a lot of the greatest builders of infrastructure, they've been, you know, they're very entrepreneurial, they're very innovative, and they've done it through government. So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't cut private through public. It cuts more through, I'll give you a perfect example. In 1997, I was in Hong Kong, then Shanghai, and then Beijing, and I was traveling with a guy who worked for me who was a PRC citizen. We had a program at MIT that we would hire people in, and we got a lot of great sort of kids coming from China going to MIT. Anyway, he was with me, and I was there when Deng died, so we were there I was in Beijing for the week of the funeral. And there was a big war going on between the U.S. at the time. It was the Clinton administration and the Beijing administration. It was all supposedly on human rights. It was the so-called soft revolution. Words were flying back and forth, and this wonderful guy worked for me. We were sitting looking at the paper, having breakfast in Beijing, and he said, "Do you understand what this fight is about?" And I said, "No, I really don't. I really do not understand." And he said, 70 or 80% of our politicians and legislators are engineers and some economists, but basically you've got engineers." And he said, "You know, 80% of yours are lawyers. And the lawyers are making more rules for the engineers and saying you will do this, and the engineers are shrugging their shoulders and saying how?" But you know, if you look at China right now, and I do think they're, you know, they've got a much higher percentage of engineers and builders in their back, you know, in their leadership. You know, what are they competing on? They're competing on high-speed trains, they're competing on infrastructure, they're competing on water projects, they're competing on power plants, and they're trying to build forward because they know to maintain the growth they have to, and they know to sort of establish themselves globally. And if you look at what we're doing, you know, we're kind of getting outfoxed on them in that respect. And that calls for a change of leadership. And I wanted to just read you something because I did an interview on the Solari Report. You know, I do these interviews and they turn out to be life-changing moments you didn't expect. But I did an interview with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the chief of staff to Powell when he was over at the Joint Chiefs, and then also when he was Secretary of State. It was a magical moment when I started to get into this issue of the infrastructure. So let me just read this to you. I was asking him about the 2016 elections and whether he thought we'd have a chance to have an intelligent discussion on any national security issues, and here's what he said. "I would hope so, but I don't think so. And what would that consist of? In my mind, first and foremost, it would consist of articulating sometime, because I'm a military guy, a grand strategy to which the United States is going to hook itself up to its economic engine. What you've got to say is, what are we wanting to do in the world and how are we going to refurbish our economy to do it? You aren't going to do anything of any note or any consequence unless you refurbish our economy. That means $2-4 trillion of expenditure on infrastructure. It means not building the old infrastructure, but building the new." And then he describes what that looks like. And then he says, "I don't think Mario Rubio, Jeb Bush, Hillary Clinton, or anybody is capable of doing that or else wanting to do that." And I said, "Right. So it looks to me they're much more interested in, you know, building monopolies." And Wilkerson said, "They're more interested in power, period, and they think that's where the power is. I've got news for them. I just sat on the Climate Security Working Group now for a year. I've switched over from Collaborative Institute on Oceans at UMass Boston, and we're working with DOD. We just did some sea rise charts for coastal installations like Norfolk and Mayport, San Francisco, San Diego, and so forth. Let me tell you, These entities are either going to spend millions of dollars for Netherlands-like water abatement apparatuses, walls and so forth, or they're going to relocate. This is billions and billions of dollars. Miami is going to have to do this. We've already got a problem in Norfolk, and we already got a problem with Langley Air Force Base, which you wouldn't think you would have because the runways are being flooded. This is serious. This is real, and it's not mid-century. It's just a few years away. Now, if you look at the criticality of the U.S. military, particularly the Navy, to the dollar as reserve currency, you know, what we're talking about is the capacity to continue to be the reserve currency, depending on infrastructure, which is not being attended to. And the reality is, who do we have as the leading candidates, according to the polls right now, for president of the United States? A bunch of wealthy lawyers, you know, who have a record of they or their families being very good at running around the world and extracting, you know, bribes from, you know, emerging market countries in exchange for, you know, getting a hold of cheap natural resources or engineering financial fraud. But that's not what you need if you're going to maintain, you know, the infrastructure. And I don't mean just the infrastructure, roads and bridges in the United States. I mean the infrastructure that is the platform upon which the U.S. dollar as reserve currency stands.
Do you have any other panaceas, you know, to help get officials on the right path?
Well, I don't know. The problem we have, Chris, is the United States created the world's greatest financial engineering tool, and that was the U.S. federal credit. And the problem is that the U.S. federal credit has simply, you know, through the reserve currency and through the treasury market, simply over, you know, we have a balance sheet taxation system through the U.S. federal credit and the U.S. dollar. And the problem is if you're not going to preserve the infrastructure upon which that stands, then the only feedback loop that's going to get people to wake up and deal with it is a complete failure. Now, you know, there are a lot of people who've been on Goldseek explaining the dangers of this, but the reality is we're eating away at both our physical, our spiritual, our cultural, and our financial infrastructure. We've been, you know, extending it while we suck more and more money out. I presume to switch to what I call Global 3.0. Who knows where all this money's going? But you know, we are wearing the whole thing thin, just as when you drive around this country, in many parts of the country, you know, it's now a second or third world infrastructure. The same thing is happening behind the scenes to the financial infrastructure.
We see Illinois up against the ropes. We see, of course, Detroit. It looks as though this issue will accelerate in the years to come.
Well, here's the thing. I had a pastor in Washington who used to say, God does not bless a mess. Plenty of money, there are plenty of resources. So, you know, we say everything's in trouble. You know, if you run things like, you know, Animal House, you're going to get a mess. Doesn't mean it has to be a mess, but it's going to take leadership and it's going to take a lot of change, including cultural change, to turn it around. If you would give me simply half of the money this country spent on gambling, you know, that would be enough resources to turn the whole country around. And the leadership's not making us do that. That we're all doing that of our own free will.
I wonder if we could move on to another interesting Solari report. You discussed in the second quarter equity overview, you call it, a risk analysis that I think would be so helpful for our listeners today. Give us a bullet-by-bullet overview, please.
Basically, what happened in the second quarter, we had a much stronger market in the much stronger markets in the emerging markets than we expected in the first quarter, and you had China run up about 25% year to date, a little bit higher. Same with Germany, and then the second quarter corrected, and the correction continued, and then after the second quarter, after the June 30 close, they were up about 11% on the large Chinese large caps after being up about 26%. Obviously, we had a real meltdown in China for the last sort of period since then. So last 10 days, business days of the last 10 days. And Germany held its own. The U.S. market has run up quite a bit for the last 4 years. And I keep saying, you know, and I start to feel really boring, Chris. We are overdue for a 10 to 25% correction. If I say that one more time, I'll make ourselves sick. But the U.S. has had quite a run, and we are way overdue for a correction. I'm a great believer. It looks like we're starting to get that correction. The S&P is flat for the year. It ran up in the first quarter, and now it's flat for the year. China, approximately, depending on what you're looking at, flat for the year. Although year-to-date, they're still very strong. Now, you've seen a lot of fear talk about the Asian markets in the paper as the meltdown occurred over the last week. The reality is we started this year, if you looked at the China ETF, again, I'm using the large cap, China PEs were trading at 9 or 10, and the U.S. is trading at 18. So you have to get this in perspective. Yeah, the China had run up, but it was still, you know, it had run up to 11 or 12 times earning. It was still very cheap relative to the U.S. markets. Anyway, so which is to say the U.S. and China are both overdue for correction. And, of course, it's summer, and the reality is 95% of the gains in the U.S. stock market occur from November to June. And so way overdue for correction. It's summer, and there's a whole lot of politics going on. And it gets back to the big question, Chris, are we going to make money collaborating or competing? If you look at what the political tensions between the U.S., China, and Russia have been over the last 6 months, that competition has been very, very deflationary to global growth. So we're feeling my number one sort of lead trend for top picks stories in the second quarter was deflation wars. And, of course, part of that is the turn in the bond market, it appears, is finally upon us. Now, my big concern that I keep talking about, and I talked about it again in the second quarter equity overview, is if the U.S. does start to pull up interest rates, even very modestly, it's going to throw a bear trap on the U.S. dollar in the emerging markets. Because coming out of the global financial crisis, 2008-2009, with the bailouts, you know, we made cheap dollars available globally, and we levered up the developing world. Coming into the financial crisis, the developed world was levered up, but not the developing world. We now have people who borrowed cheap dollars all around the world. If dollars get more expensive, you know, the U.S. is going to have a big leash, and that leash is going to get jerked. So the emerging markets, stock markets, have done surprisingly well. But I'm really concerned if the dollar does continue to go up. It was up 12% last year. It's up 5 or 6% so far this year. If the Fed does raise interest rates, we could really see the, you know, sort of global dollar borrowers get clobbered.
You know, I'm certainly expecting the trend to continue here with the greenback. We're most likely going to see a rate hike, as you know, in September, and probably another token rate hike in December. The combination, that impact, probably two and done is what we'll see for a while. But still, you know, the Fed governors and the chair there are talking about around 3% as their target rate over the next several years. So that's going to give the traders the impetus I think they need to back and support the U.S. dollar, but local, our domestic multinationals, which will continue to suffer as a result because of they lose some of that competitive advantage due to the currency play.
Right, and one of the strongest areas in the U.S. markets has been tech after healthcare, and tech has the highest exposure to foreign earnings. So it's going to be. It's going to put quite a headwind on tech.
So many people are riding that momentum play, that trade right now. I mean, that's certainly something to think about. I like your comments on valuations, and this is something that people are losing sight of.
I do think we're way overdue for 10 to 25% correction. That's only healthy. But here's why I disagree. We have piled high in the bond market trillions and trillions of dollars, and in the derivative market. That money has been stockpiled, and it's been kept out of the real economy because otherwise it would kick off inflation. That money is now going to start to shift into the real economy in a variety of different ways. I mean, if you look at the demands for infrastructure, if we can figure out how to do it, you know, what a great use of the money. But it's going to move out into the real economy now, and we're going to shift to something that's much more equity-based globally in terms of our global investment model. That's a good thing. But that money's got to go someplace. So it's going to go to real estate, it's going to go to commodities, it's going to stay in cash, or it's going to go to equities. And I just think part of what you've been seeing, and it's a lot of it's been happening through the governmental entities, whether it's sovereign wealth funds, central banks, pension funds. It's been moving into the equity markets. The equity markets in 1990, Chris, were globally 11 trillion. Now they're 70 trillion. I think they're going to move up to about 150 trillion, not from price. It's going to be, you're going to see, you know, companies all around the world that are moving. Those emerging markets are going to grow and grow and grow. And the multinationals are going to grow.
Well, that's right. But we're also seeing a systemic shift because, as you know, the 30-year bond market bull is coming to a close here. I mean, obviously, you can't have a bull market amid higher rates. We've seen low rates for so long. There's a whole group of investors out there who have never even invested in an environment that we're about to enter into. So you're going to see a primary shift away from bonds and interest-sensitive investments, of course, into less so, and that makes equities more appealing.
Well, here's the question. Is it going to be away from bonds? Or are bonds going to turn, or are they going to plateau?
I would have to be in the camp that agrees with Bill Gross, you know, the former bond king, if you will. It looks like we're going to see a major shift. That's not to say that people won't have bonds in their portfolios. You'll see corporations investing far less of those resources that the Fed has disseminated, as you pointed to earlier, into their own bonds. And you'll see a greater emphasis on their own shares moving forward. And that, of course, those buybacks and related mergers and acquisitions tends to be a solid underpinning for, you know, stock market advances.
You know, that's the challenge the U.S. faces. If you're trading at a relative high PE relative to the world, and a lot of that growth in PE over the last 3 or 4 years has depended on borrowing cheap money and doing buybacks and sort of shrinking your capitalization, you know, what's the next game? If you have to, you know, if you have to create real earnings in a real economy, well, that's why they're pushing for the fast track authority and all these trade agreements. They're trying to figure out a way to jump the curve on corporate earnings over the next 5 to 10 years.
And, you know, there's so many hurdles to overcome there because of, as you say, we've just been focusing on the wrong areas as a society.
Well, here's a funny thing. If you look at what those trade agreements are going to do, they're going to do a couple things. But one is they're going to put enormous stress on your infrastructure. So if you're going to pass all those trade agreements, you better start investing in the infrastructure to handle the growth that you think you're going to get and you're trying to get. And if you're going to do that, maybe you should stop running lawyers for president.
We've just alienated our one lawyer listener, all right?
Well, here's the thing. I love great lawyers. Great lawyers saved my life. There is nothing better in this world than great lawyers. But here's the reality. What we're talking about in terms of Washington, and, you know, because actually one of my favorite congressmen is Alan Grayson, and he's a wealthy lawyer, so, you know, there's exception to every rule, but you can't have everybody be lawyer. You know, that is unhealthy, balance in all things. And the reality is, you know, I'll never forget, this is a funny story, Chris. I was sitting in my office on Wall Street, and I had a wonderful partner who came in and he said, I'm helping this guy run for Senate and governor in New Hampshire. I want you to come listen to him. And John Sununu walked in, and he sat down, and what he said is, there are no engineers or congressmen, maybe there's one, and I'm a scientist and engineer. Here's how many laws pass a year related to science and engineering, and this is why you should help me. And I wrote a check for everything in my checking account. Every dollar, I gave it to him, and he was absolutely right. And so, you know, it's the same thing. You cannot run a society. If you go back and look at all the great civilizations, you know, they engineered infrastructures that made sure that they won, whether it was in terms of their relationship with nature or their ability to compete with other societies or to manage all the different risks we put up with, let alone having productive, you know, a dense productive infrastructure that makes humans productive. And it's a critical ingredient. And so you can't just have lawyers. And unfortunately, we have too many lawyers.
Take a look at Teddy Roosevelt, you know, the Rough Rider, that type of generation. Now, that's not to say we need another Theodore Roosevelt in the White House. You know, someone who can bring a wealth of knowledge and background that maybe offsets the pendulum a little bit.
Well, here's the thing. We've got, you know, basically who's risen to power are people who are good at rigging government money and government credit. And if you're going to put your money in the real economy, that is not what creates real returns. You know, I got news for you. Mr. Global just stole $40 trillion. He needs a 5% return. That's $2 trillion a year to run whatever it is, you're not going to get those returns if you're trying to get it with rigging everything with government money, because all you do is destroy the real economy.
How do we encourage folks, how do we foster this need for people in there with the tools, the background, the initiative, the drive, the determination, you know, the spirit, the entrepreneurial spirit, and the wherewithal to accomplish these goals?
If every one of us in our lives, when we're dealing, whether it's we're voting, first of all, your local elections and your local leadership is very important because this cascades bottom up. But, you know, whether you're dealing with your university and your university endowment, because a lot of the shenanigans run through the university endowments, whether you're dealing with your the not-for-profits that ask you for money, whether you're dealing with your stock portfolio, whether you're dealing with where you work or, you know, who you buy from, every day as you go through your life and you invest your time and money, say, you know something, I've had it with, I'm not supporting those people, and I'm going to start demanding accountability. I'm not supporting it. It's not fashionable anymore to be a racketeer.
But Catherine Austin Fitz, wouldn't you say that a big component of this story is the entitlement society? And let me just throw in here anecdotally, one of the issues we're facing is when a system sort of reaches that point, I mean, we see this throughout history and we've heard warnings throughout history, when your democracy becomes inundated with people at the top just dishing out to each different group and they're catering to their specific needs, you really set up kind of a self-fulfilling downward spiral.
Yeah, but here's the entitlement that's a problem. The entitlement in our society that's killing us is that people who can kill with impunity can have anything they want. That's the entitlement that's hurting us. And so you have to have government leadership that has the power and the ability to say no without getting their control file slapped all over the Washington Post or, you know, having their children or themselves assassinated. You know, that's the tough issue. There's if you look at what the so-called entitlements, they're tiny compared to, you know, $8.5 trillion has gone missing, you know, primarily from DOD and the intelligence-related agencies. You know, that's the entitlement that's killing us. You know, I think you want to be very careful about the entitlement thing, because now that they've stolen all the money out, they're going to say, oh, well, there's no money. We need to cut back on entitlement. So the reality is that the allocation of capital in the society is done by highly political means, and they relate to who's really good at dirtball. And that's got to be dealt with. And frankly, one of the ways that each one of us can deal with it is stop making the people who do it fashionable. Stop making it socially acceptable to behave that way. So the reality is, you know, we have the greatest power in society is the power to shun. We have the ability to shun these people. The day they stop being fashionable is the day that the people who can build great infrastructure projects, you know, can get in there and do something. I mean, imagine what Wilkerson said. Imagine if we put together a vision of how America could lead economically in terms of building and creating things, not just controlling and destroying things. You know, so we had something to offer the world other than surveillance systems. So imagine if America led, because America to this day, I think, still has for a large, you know, a great, we have great natural resources, we have great sort of an infrastructure base. If half the money that's gone into covert infrastructure has gone in, that I think, then we have a great covert infrastructure.
So. We're a nation of spies. It's certainly food for thought. I wonder if you could give us an idea then how you see this shaping up. If you had to look out into the future, you know, I think you raised the idea of either collaboration or conflict between the BRIC nations. And you bring up, you know, Russia and China. I'm in the camp who seem to believe that, you know, we need to collaborate more, admit our faults, and then we need to see, hey, what's working for them?
Well, here's the thing. I'm not a great believer that anybody got anywhere by showing anybody their jugular. So the reality is, if you look at the BRIC nations, you know, we've played dirtball with them, and I think we have to be careful about how we proceed. But it is absolutely true on any place where we can cooperate in terms of producing excellence in infrastructure and sort of economic well-being globally, we want to do it. And so I think It's a matter of having to be good at multiple things. But we can't just play soft revolution where we dictate, you know, quote unquote humanitarian terms while playing dirtball. I mean, we're relying too much on force, whether it's covert force or military force. We've got to start competing successfully on, you know, on places where we can cooperate, in areas where we can cooperate. And I think that's one of the reasons they're pushing the fast track, because you're trying to draw in the allies who you believe you can cooperate with.
You know, you talk about exposing the jugular. We are sticking our necks out, I think, economically, and in particular in a monetary fashion, because as we all know, the borrower is slave to the lender, and we have essentially put ourselves up to our eyeballs in debt with many of the BRIC nations. Is this going to be an Achilles heel on a forward basis?
Oh, I don't think so, because we can pay our debt all day long. They can't print dollars, and they've borrowed dollars. So to me, this is a very, very big leash that we've put out into the developing world. It's going to be interesting to see how we play it. It's one of the backdrops to all of this is proceeding apace this year, robot sales are red hot. And if you look at what's going on with robotics, what we've got is a powerful deflationary force. One of the reasons we haven't experienced monetary inflation is we've had very powerful deflation of labor globally with globalization and automation. And robotics is the next, and artificial intelligence is the next round of that. And it's particularly going to hit the white collar groups.
In line with your thoughts, we're looking at a loss of up to half of the current jobs to automation and robotics over just the next decade. And that's going to be a big shift, don't you think?
It's an enormous shift, and it's a shift that makes politicians very nervous. I mean, part of, I think, of what we're seeing is it's putting tremendous stress, you know, on people who are in responsible political positions to kind of handle that transition. Now, if you look at what we want to do in space, what we have to do with infrastructure, just from the size of the population or the growth in the economy, we need that capacity, but it's a matter of helping people transition from here to there. And America, you know, it's interesting. In the 90s, I sat down and there was a group of leaders in Washington who said, okay, we need to help the American people jump the curve on, you know, on what's coming and retool. And another group said, no, no, let's just lever them up. And that was the plan that got implemented. The reality is when you go through these kinds of transitions, you need to give a pathway to your labor force to retool and transition. You know, the Germans did it, you know, did a great job of that, I think, compared to us over the last, you know, since World War II. And we have traditionally been, you know, hey, babes, you're on your own. Let's leave you high and dry. We don't care. And you know, doing that while we're basically stealing their tax dollars. So
in the past, the cliche answer was, well, we'll just all be a nation of, what was it, burger flippers and greeters at Walmart. Well, that's going to soon be gone.
Sure. I'm not sure the greeters are going to be gone, because the customers want to be greeted by a human.
How long before you can't tell the difference before the Turing test is passed?
Don't start me down that topic.
I know. Well, there's so much great topicality that I would love to put before you today. We've already run over on time way too much. We'll have to pick up the conversation, hopefully at a later date. I mean, you have so many venues and areas of interest.
Yeah, actually, what I'm interested in, you know, my goal is to help my subscribers successfully navigate this environment we call free and inspired. You know, sort of no matter what's going on, I want to have a free and inspired life. I want my subscribers to as well. So we tend to look at the full balance sheet. So I'm looking at their balance sheet, and I'm looking at both the macro and micro of what's going on and trying to figure out how they can navigate. And it gets complicated because they're all over the world. It's a big planet. Anyway, so we tend to look at the whole balance sheet, both micro and macro. But I publish the Solari Report. We do a money and markets once a week on Thursday night, except for the last week of the month. And then an interview, so an in-depth interview. And then my favorite part of the Solari Report is quarterly. We do a big wrap-up both on the equity markets. We do a wrap-up on the precious metals markets, and we do a wrap-up. We do the wrap-up of wrap-ups, and it's to help people see the big themes, the big shifts, because what I've discovered is, you know, on any of these topics, if you really want to understand how the money works, there's no way you're going to find it in the sort of the bread and circus entertainment media, the corporate media, you know, they're busy trying to get control of the money, so they're not teaching you how to get control of yours. And then, of course, there's a lot of great stuff on the internet, but a lot of it I find is gloom and doom. And
oh, that's so true. And, you know, it's really asking the fox for security measures on the hen house. That's what we're really looking to. People are turning to the wrong folks, you know, for the information. So it sounds like you have an alternative here.
Well, here's what I believe. The only person who can govern your resources, whether it's your time or your money, is you, and you have to govern it, and you need to get information from a variety of sources. I'm a great believer in sunshine and disclosure, and so, you know, you need to get it, but more than anything, you need to get it in a way that leaves you in a coherent state. So what we're trying to do is and there are plenty of risks in this environment, Chris. You know how tricky and dangerous this environment can be, you know, because it's become relatively lawless to what we enjoyed 20 or 30 years ago. But I think you can deal with a lawless environment and still remain coherent. So the Solarium report is basically what we're trying to do is bring you information. And one of the reasons I love the wrap-ups, if you're so busy that you can only read the news four times a year, the wrap-up is designed to make sure you understand what's going on and you have basically the 411 on what's important, and that's all you have to do for the whole year. So if your news diet is only, you know, 10 hours a year, then get the Solarium report wrap-ups.
Oh, exactly. And if you're also experiencing information overload, as so many of us are. I have Solari.com and the blog bookmarked right now on my website, and I want to encourage everybody to do so. It's Solari, Solari.com/blog. Catherine Austin Fitz, great information. Please return to the show.
Have a great day, Chris, and thanks for the opportunity again to be on your show. Great show.
Well, my featured guest today says that gold could blast higher by 25-fold and gold equities by 50-fold. Avi Gilbert, founder of ElliottWaveTrader.net live trading room member forum, which focuses on Elliott Wave. We're all familiar with that here at GoldSeek. Welcome, Avi.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Great to have you here. And your claim to some folks might seem a bit over the top. 25,000 is a factor of several fold above where we are, even above the 2011 peak. But maybe from an inflation adjusted level and monetary silliness we've seen, I guess is the most euphemistic way to put it, around the world, this number makes some sense. Tell us more, please.
Well, actually, it's technically a 50-year projection where, you know, a lot of the people listening probably have to be thinking about leaving their gold and their miners to their children, or even grandchildren. But it's a 50-year projection, and it's using the same methodology that allowed us to identify the top within $6 of the top back in 2011. I remember when I published that, you know, once we hit 1950, you may want to cash in your gold because we could see a very sizable correction. I remember people were laughing about that as well, getting the same reaction when I'm saying, you know, I'm expecting the market to bottom out sometime over the next few months, maybe even as much as 6 months. And once that occurs, I'm looking for the resumption of a major multi-decade long-term bull market.
No, I'm on board with you. You know, we've had Jim Rogers here as well. He's watching for the same thing. There's still a lot of bullishness. It wouldn't hurt to see a washout to $800, $900, $1,000 an ounce. And that would set the stage technically, fundamentally even, for a good solid bull market. But you also have an interesting forecast for the equities. And our listeners here today, Avi, are big fans of the Gold Bug Index, our bread and butter. And many of our advertisers are in that camp as well. You're looking at a potentially meteoric rise here. This could really be something. What are some of the fundamental drivers that you see behind that?
I'm not a fundamentalist, shall we say. Now, unfortunately, fundamentals have led many people astray in this market for the last 4 years. We are purely based on sentiment and mathematics. That's really, like I said, it's what identified the top to us back in 2011 within $6 of the top. And before we even topped, we had the region we now find ourselves in as a primary target. As what I'm looking at over a very long-term period, we were looking for the HUI gold bugs index to come down to the 100 region. Of course, you know, it could spike lower on overreactions, but, you know, we've almost come to our target now from a very long-term perspective as to where we're looking for a bottom. So we've actually started, the funny thing is we just rolled out a miners service. We're giving our specific picks about miners, and a week from this past Friday, which actually hit the actual low we've seen so far in the in the GDX, for example, we actually started legging into some very long-term positions for specific miners, which we think may have bottomed already. Most of the miners have not. But we're looking at a number of them that we think, you know, they may have bottomed, but we're watching them very closely. So we're looking at this entire complex as it's time to start thinking about buying bottoms rather than shorting.
Well, that's certainly contrarian, I think, to the prevailing sentiment. Move on to the general equities markets. You keep a close eye on this sector as well. It's been a very challenging time since the plunge of about a month ago. Of course, the Fed, they didn't pull the trigger on higher rates as they'd been promising for quite some time. This gives some mixed signals. You know, on the one hand, that would seem to indicate, are they just trying to support the global economy, which is sluggish right here, or do they really see difficult times ahead for the domestic economy, perhaps another recession in the future? So that's unnerved some investors. Give us an idea of what you're seeing in the charts.
When it comes to the Fed, I've been writing for a number of years that ultimately I believe the Fed will wind up being completely discredited. Their financial engineering is not going to be anywhere near as powerful as people ultimately believe. So that's something we put on the side. We really don't deal with that. The Fed is really not as much of a concern to us. But coming into 2015, we were actually quite bullish, especially in the Russell. We were riding the IWM, but as the market progressed through the spring, we started seeing signs that, you know, we're not going to get to the ultimate targets we wanted to see this year. So once the market and the IWM hit 129, we got out of our positions, which fortuitously, I think we got out within 40 cents or so of the actual high hit. So while the market was consolidating over the summer, we were in a wait-and-see mode, and we said once 2040 breaks, we're looking for a large correction. So far, the market has basically hit my minimal target for this long-term correction. I don't believe we're done. I think we may still be flopping around a bit for the next few weeks, but I still foresee the market still going higher than where we hit last week. I still think there's that potential, but I think it's probably going to wind up being a setup that's going to take us into the very low 1800s, but more likely we can even see a 17 handle.
For the most part, then, somewhat bearish here on the sector. Do you have any idea then whether or not you see a resumption of the bull market, technically speaking, once this pullback is over?
The answer is absolutely. I actually just put out a long-term update to my members this past weekend. And I don't believe this bull market is done by any stretch of the imagination yet. I still think that it's going to take us another month or two until this correction has run its course. I don't think right now the lower end of my target region for this correction is 1694 on the SPX. If we break 1694 in any significant way or have a setup to break it more than what I'm seeing right now, then I'll become a lot more defensive. But as it stands right now, based on what I'm seeing, the next larger decline that I'm looking for seems to be going out to maybe Thanksgiving or so. I'm looking at that as a potential buying opportunity. I'm going to watch to see how we develop, because the how is more important than, but the how is what I'll be watching. And if it develops in the manner in which I'm looking for, I'm looking at it as a long-term buying opportunity. I still think the S&P 500 is going to be approaching 2,500.
You know, we've had on the show a number of guests recently. Martin Armstrong comes to mind, Arch Crawford, and some of these folks are convinced that there is a technical cycle, if you will, or let's just call it a rhythm, a harmonic, if you prefer, a wave that runs through the markets about every 7 years or so, referred to as the Shemitah Jubilee Year. You've expressed your own viewpoint and some on this. And interestingly, this cycle comes to a peak this year, 2015, right around this time. Give us an idea of whether or not you see that tied in with the increase in volatility in the equity sector.
I smile about it when I hear these type of analysis based upon Shemitah, and in Hebrew it's called the Yovel, in English it's called the Jubilee. I'm actually an Orthodox Jew, and you know, so this is more of a religious perspective than it is for a stock market perspective. I mean, if people go back and look at what, you know, Shemitah years, or even more importantly, Yovel years have meant to the market, you're not going to really see anything significant. It really is a religious perspective more than a societal and market perspective. So I don't believe that anything is happening right now is due because of the Shemitah or the Yovel. Personally, I just think the market hit its upside target. It's now in a correction, and it's just going to set up to continue higher. You know, that's my primary focus at the moment.
Avi, give me an idea, if you would, please, what else you're watching right now. My guess is you have your eyes on several markets. You might be West Texas Intermediate Crude. You might be looking at commodities. Give us an idea of anything else you'd like to share with the listeners as we wrap up.
I don't think that, like many people think, that oil has bottomed. I'm not so confident that oil has bottomed. In fact, I still see it that it can potentially go higher still, but I don't foresee that it has bottomed just yet. I think we're probably going to retest the prior lows, if not make lower lows. And then I think, just like in the metals, I think we'll then have a very long-term bottom in place.
You know, I see the same thing. Technically speaking, I like the idea of not trying to catch this knife as it falls. Why don't you tell our listeners, please, about all the interesting services you provide? You've got a great staff of people working with you. It sounds like you all are very close and comrades in arms. Give us an idea of what they'll find at your website, please.
Thank you so much. Actually, today is actually our 4-year anniversary, which is actually quite interesting. But we have 10 analysts on our site. We cover world markets, U.S. equity markets, all the stocks on the U.S. markets. We cover a number of stocks on foreign markets. We have a mining stock portfolio. We have one gentleman that is solely focused just on mining stocks alone. We do short-term trading with mining stocks, of all things. A lot of people love doing this, the 3x ETF trading on the miners. We have a gentleman that focuses solely on that. He's up over 150% total return this year on that alone. We have a Forex service that covers all the major and minor pairs. We have somebody that handles options. We basically cover most of the world when it comes to markets with our 10 analysts. And we have thousands of people that are on our site. On a given day, you'll have at least 1,000 people in our trading room exchanging ideas, discussing trades.
Avi, what about folks who are more long-term oriented? Is there a section, a room, a chat area, a forum for folks who just don't have the time or inclination for intraday investing and trading and really just prefer to build a solid portfolio? Is there something like that in mind for them?
Absolutely. I mean, our stock analysis is for both short-term and very long-term perspectives, as well as our mining stock portfolio. Our mining stock portfolio is something we're looking at, you know, 20, 30 years ahead of time.
That's what most of our investors here today have, that longer-term focus. So, Avi Gilbert, thanks for being here. We're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Thank you ever so much for having me.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold. gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. A long-awaited speculation ended today with China's announcement of their official gold holdings. An article titled, China Ends Mystery of Gold Hoard to Top Russia's Holdings, appeared on Bloomberg and confirmed a 57% jump in reserves, overtaking Russia to become the country with the fifth largest supply of gold. China's bullion assets increased from 1,054 tons reported in 2009 to 1,658 tons reported now. The U.S. still reports its gold assets at a stagnant 8,133 tons, even though those assets have not been officially audited for decades. Keep in mind, it was only about a month ago Bloomberg estimated Chinese gold holdings could likely triple in this announcement to roughly 3,500 tons of gold, factoring in such metrics as domestic output and China Gold Association trade figures. Others in the gold community estimated holdings as high as 10,000 tons of gold. Was Bloomberg wrong? Were experts in the gold community wrong? Or does China have more gold than the 1,658 tons that was officially announced today, but perhaps they have now adopted U.S.-style reporting protocols to mislead the public and announce lower gold holdings with certainty, and never acknowledge the remaining gold in an official capacity? A form of psychological misdirection or escalated gold wars? They could call it off-budget gold, or deep storage gold, or some other name internally. I only speculate. But it is a very real possibility, because 1,658 tons on the surface seems to be a real lowball number. Remember, we have taught the world how to misdirect with official statistics. Our headlines only emphasize the U3 unemployment rate, currently about 5.3%, which is roughly half the U6 unemployment rate, currently about 10.5%. But real unemployment has been calculated at over double the U6 rate by shadowstats.com at a rate of 23.1%. And let's not forget how we report on the federal debt in this country. This past week, I heard two presidential candidates speak in person, Marco Rubio and Donald Trump, and both continued the misleading debt rhetoric of an $18 trillion federal debt. Yes, that is the acknowledged and advertised federal debt, much like the low 5.3% U3 unemployment number that is discussed and promoted, and dare I say, accepted by most learned people who frankly should know better. But they are only fooling themselves with that number. Because, as we all know, there are off-budget debt obligations and unfunded liabilities. According to Lawrence Kotlikoff and his analysis of CBO figures, that actually increased the real debt to $205 trillion. So, as you can see, the low debt of $18 trillion is a real misnomer. The low unemployment of 5.3% is a real misnomer. And China's announcement today of only 1,658 tons of gold may be a misnomer. What I do know for certain is that the gold wars discussed by Ferdinand Lips in his book entitled Gold Wars are alive and well and taking on new dimensions every day. I also know you must anticipate the future and act on it in advance. Because despite the lackluster performance of gold relative to China's announcement, here's where we were with the gold price in 2010, just 1 year before it exploded to its all-time high of $1,900 an ounce. It was reported today that for immediate delivery, gold is at the $1,136 an ounce mark, which is down to its lowest level since 2010. Based on, guess what? Speculation the U.S. Federal Reserve will raise interest rates. Well, they have been speculating week after week, month after month, and year after year for the past 5 years, and the 3 years before that, that they have been going to raise interest rates. They haven't, and they can't. Or they risk upsetting, or worse, tanking the system and the debt they have disguised and financed with cheap money. They are masters at playing the game of financial chicken. As long as they are successful at that, they will continue to win the gold wars. Now it looks like China may be taking a cue from the West, assuming they have more gold somewhere than the officially reported 1,658 tons. If that's the case, I wonder what they are going to get in return. Perhaps a wider acceptance and market for their currency? I don't think we'll have too long to wait to find out. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. Several years ago, our listeners will recall I hosted a series of teleseminars on gold and the economy, and I will soon begin hosting a series of free Conquer Change webinars. So please sign up at conquerchange.com, and until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.